Talk given Sunday, 26th October, 1975. Throughout our lives, we use the word I constantly. We use words like myself or he every day of our lives. What exactly are we referring to when we use the word I? In the ordinary way, surely, the word I is simply a concept, an idea which we use to denote our own living body. Perhaps we would like to include in that a soul or a mind or mental processes. We use terms like immortal soul or spirit or spark of the divine and so forth. But what precisely do we mean by those things? This word mind, like the word the self, is something which we just don't know. What do we mean by mind? We are aware of thoughts and feelings, as we say. Feelings are rather useful to consider in this context, because although we can name them, we cannot define them so precisely as we can define a thought, for the simple reason that a thought is just a string of words, a string of words which corresponds to reality in one way only, namely, the sense impressions we receive from any actual thing or person or event. These sense impressions, synthesized by our faculty of speech, we learn the vocabulary, we know the meanings of the words of the language we use, and therefore our thoughts become more or less precise, but our feelings are considerably imprecise. If I say a grand piano, that grand piano is a lovely instrument. There is considerable precision to that statement. But if I say, I am feeling depressed or angry, or I am feeling fine, elated, what precisely is anger, depression, elation, feeling fine? What is its intensity? It is not measurable. See, this is where a considerable difference comes in. So we can just say, well, in addition to the body, there are mental processes. And added on to that are numerous beliefs which spring up because of the conditioning we undergo by virtue of our socio-cultural heritage. If we are members of the great religions of the world, with one exception, Buddhism in this case, we talk of something which is immortal, eternal, divine, perfect, etc., etc. Sometimes we use the word spirit. Well, what precisely do we mean by that? Is there such a thing? The Buddhist analysis of the individual is an analysis which presents the person whom you see before your before you, as body and mental processes, feelings, thoughts, volitions, intentions, consciousness. It doesn't say anything else. In fact, it denies that any of these have anything like a permanent, abiding entity, a mysterious, immaterial entity. All the other religions, and not only the religions, but quite apart from religion, most of the people of the world believe that there is some immortal, mysterious, immaterial entity inside them, which is their innermost self, as they call it. But this is purely a postulate. Does it correspond to any fact, to truth, reality? This is what we have to understand clearly. If you look at this statement, that there is an immortal, immaterial entity, you will see that it is a self-contradictory statement. The very word entity, something particular, means that it is limited, it is finite. It comes into being, has its span of manifestation of life, and then it passes away, it dies, as we call it. It cannot be an entity. It cannot be limited. It cannot be finite. There's no such thing, therefore, as my immortal soul or my little bit of the divine spirit. The moment we are out of the realm of the limited and the finite, we are trying to reach out into the infinite, the immeasurable. And if it is of the nature of the infinite, the immeasurable, then it cannot be possessed and cannot specifically belong to me, a finite mortal creature. It is something universal. Just as the space in which we all live and in which all things are is infinite, immeasurable, and is not the property of either a galaxy or a star or a mosquito or a man or anything at all. See, these are the things we don't consider carefully when we try to understand the self. We like to believe about ourselves that there is an perfect, immortal entity. It's this entity idea which brings in all the trouble. Because it ties up with our ego misconception of ourselves, our egoistic misconception of ourselves. The reality is, what that reality is, we can know, come to understand only in a very small degree. But the moment we make statements about something immortal and so on, we have to be extremely careful, because in practically every case we misstate the fact. But you see, there are tremendous consequences to this. If there is no immaterial, immortal entity, which is my real self, as I like to postulate. It completely throws out heaven, hell, rewards, punishments, and all the rest of it after the death of the body. It completely finishes off. And of course, the bulk of human beings do not like that idea at all. They say, heavens, you're preaching annihilation. I'm not. This is not a doctrine of annihilation at all. Because whatsoever is undergoes continuous transformation, but it cannot be annihilated. We use the term annihilation in various contexts, just as a convenient word to express the intensity of what we think or feel. For instance, your scientist says that a tiny bit of matter is annihilated in an atomic explosion. It is not annihilated. That tiny bit of matter has now become heat, light, and so on. Science itself knows only too well the interconvertibility of matter and energy. So there is no such thing as annihilation, certainly in the what we commonly call the physical universe. This is not to suggest that the physical universe is separate from a spiritual universe. We use words like spiritual, mental, physical, immaterial and material in a very loose way. There is no sharp division between them. The division is there in our own minds only, because we are unable to be conscious of the continuity of the totality. The homogeneity, I should say, not continuity. The homogeneity of the totality. Now, we have no illusions with respect to something which we experience through our feeling, our sense of touch, and through our sense of sight as a solid object. We have no illusion as regards a liquid. And we have no illusion as regards matter in the gaseous state, because we can feel the wind. We breathe in and out. We can blow hard. We can blow hot and cold, even, and so forth. So we have no illusions about that, and we accept that as part of the material universe. Then what is outside our sense experience, we talk of as, oh, this is in the realm of energy, heat, light, chemical energy, electrical energy, magnetic force, gravitational pull, and all sorts of things like that. And none of them can be bottled up. You can't bring a little bit of electricity for me on a saucer and say, well, there you are, there's a little bit of electricity for you. You can't do it. Nor can you do it with light. There's a little bit of light or something. And certainly we can't do it with respect to space. But we know that space is a reality. And we know that electricity and light and so forth are realities. And we call them energies. You see? But the difference is this, that they in themselves are not limited, particular, finite, subject to birth and death. That is, they are not mortal. The whole idea of mortality just is completely out of the situation. Now, the interesting part of the story is this. We do not know energy in itself. We only know its manifestations as electricity, magnetism, light, heat, chemical energy and mechanical energy and so forth. We know only the manifestations. And the important thing to remember is that the energy itself, which is manifested in this secondary condition of electricity or light or whatever it is, manifests that way because there is an actual material apparatus for its manifestation. Otherwise, it is in the realm of the unmanifest. We, as we are, with our intellects, can only logically deduce and state, yes, energy. But energy in itself is outside our experience, quite outside our control. Energy, when there is an apparatus available for it, is manifested, it is within our experience, and we can actually control electrical energy, heat energy, and so forth. It is a fact of our lives, but it needs the material. Consider then, what is matter, since science has discovered the interconvertibility of matter and energy? If you have a magnificent hydrogen bomb type explosion, well, what is matter, in this case, say, hydrogen, the gas itself, converted, the atoms are just converted into light and heat and all that kind of thing, into just energy, as we say. So matter we can regard as concretized energy. Energy in its most concrete form we call solid matter, because that is how we experience it. That is why we call it solid matter. An object like a neutrino, for instance, wouldn't call it solid matter at all. Could the neutrino talk? You see, it is of such a constitution that our words, solid, liquid, gaseous, have no meaning for it whatsoever. It is because we are constituted as we are and we function as we do. Therefore, we say the solid is the most concrete form of energy. The liquid is less concrete. A gas is even less concrete. And when we come into that which goes right beyond these three states of matter which lie within our ordinary everyday experience, we talk of energy as being utterly subtle. So we can say that energy is subtilized matter, just as we can say matter is concretized energy. Now it's important to not just to get this with our brains, with the intellect, because the intellect will merely collect a whole heap of concepts, patterns of words, but their dynamic meaning, which is what brings about understanding, escapes us if it is intellect alone which is at work. We have to become aware in the feeling manner as well as the perceiving manner. The intellect is the perceiver, but there is that other aspect of the mind which feels out the thing. And when there is the harmony of the feeling aspect and the perceiving aspect, then we begin to understand clearly. And we begin to be able to be free of the conditioning of the mind and get at the reality of the thing we are trying to understand. Now, let us relate all this to what we started with, the self. Because naturally you'll be wondering why on earth I have launched out into all this business about matter and energy when we wanted to consider the self. Now look, how easily we say, my body, my mind, my spirit. We say my body, and we are quite certain that this is my body. Yes, of course. Our certainty is legitimate, that this is my body. But now consider, just what it implies. This body has to breathe in order to live. I take that air from outside myself into myself. That is to say, now I use the word self. I take it from outside what I call my body. I take it inside my body. Now, whilst that air is inside my body, I suppose it would be perfectly logical to say that that air which I have breathed in is part of my body. But then I breathe it out. So, for a little while, it is myself, and when I breathe it out, has a part of me become unself? You see, this is a very interesting point, because now when we move from the air we breathe to the liquids we drink and the foods that we eat, we get to something subtler, although the stuff is more concrete. We eat something. We have taken that something from outside the body and put it inside the body. And it undergoes a great chemical change. Part of it is built into the structure of the cells, and part of it ultimately is rejected by the body. Now, if I were to say my body, can I exclude the apples or beef or whatever I eat from myself? Can I do so? What is myself? What is my body? And if you come to sort of really feel this out, you will find that you are always transcending the limits imposed upon the term my body, the limits imposed by the actual size of the solid body, delimited by the skin. You're transcending the limits of that and beginning to sort of move out into the world. Because if you consider the air we breathe, well, where does it come from? We say, oh, of course it's the air in the room. But you know, air is an astonishing thing. It diffuses all through. Now, supposing there's a powerful wind blowing, a gale blowing. We breathe that air, and as we breathe out, what I have breathed out goes to the other end of Britain. Well, where is myself? Where is my body? If I were to call that air which I breathed in part of my body, now where is my body? You see, it's a very elusive thing. Obviously, for all common regard and practical purposes, it's absurd to think of things in that way. But if it is necessary to think of things in that way in order to be free from our very limited perceptions. That is the importance of this. We have very limited perceptions. And so when we say my body, we do mean something quite real and quite sensible, but our minds have very limited concepts about it. Now, in the same way, we say my feelings. What do we mean by my feelings? Are feelings a thing apart by themselves? Are they not always associated with chemical reactions in the brain and the glands and in the bloodstream and so forth, all the time? Every single feeling, as we say, and we say that, oh, that's just a feeling, it's nothing material, is absolutely associated with the material of the body, the living material of the body. You can't get away from it. And it's the same with the thought. And the thinking process and the use of the faculty of speech. The brain, there's a tremendous electrical activity going on in the brain. And then as the nerves carry the impulses and so forth, according to your thinking, and we may also add your feeling, there are changes in your blood, there are changes in the various organs taking place. So now where are we? We started by splitting up ourselves into my body, my mind, my thoughts, my feelings, and so forth. But actually they are all completely interconnected all the time. So within the small sphere which goes by our name in the world, I, John Brown, will say, you see, well, within this small sphere, there is a complete interconnection between all the aspects that we can see for ourselves. But do we stop there? Having said body, material, thoughts, feelings, ideas, consciousness, having said all those things and exhausted our vocabulary, so to say, about the self, is that the end? Or is there a host of other things of which we know nothing yet? Now, we have looked into it far enough to see that when we use the word self in the ordinary way, we use it in a very restricted way. That is to say, our concept of it is extremely limited. Actually, if you think of the matter very carefully, you will see that even restricting our considerations to the body alone, this body which is composed of so many atoms, and each atom, we'll say, is so many electrons, protons, neutrons, which are universal by nature. And they are not things anymore. They are energies. An atom is not a thing like a tiny little stone you might pick up, or any particle that we know. We use the word particle, unfortunately, in connection with the atomic world. Well, that is simply because we haven't got a suitable word yet for it, apart from atom. It is a congeries of energies, an atom is. And the whole body, consisting of something like 10 with 27 noughts after it, or 1 with 28 noughts after it, consisting of so many atoms, is a congeries of energies. And energy has no limitations, as we saw earlier. Energy in itself, it's universal. So that if you really awake to this in your inner awareness, you will realize that to say my body really means the body of the entire universe itself. And so too, when we say my mind, my thoughts or my feelings, It's something universal, of which this, which one is accustomed to regard as oneself, and which has a specific name, is only a particular manifestation. It's a signpost of the universe, the whole, the totality. Now one may say, oh well, what is the point of all this metaphysics? I mean, for all practical purposes, it just doesn't apply at all. But think carefully. It does apply. Because we think in terms of my and mine, we are self-conscious in an isolated manner. And because of that isolatedness, we are out of harmony with the totality. This is how conflict begins, how conflict is maintained and made worse and worse. I, the self, as a something separate from the totality. And this is the absolute root of what we call selfishness and all that stems from selfishness. This wrong kind of self-awareness, of self-consciousness. I am different and separate from you, from things, from events, from situations, and so forth. It is because we are conscious that way that we shall everlastingly have disharmony, misery, sorrow, ill-doing, wrongdoing. We shall have violence, we shall have fear. Take the case of two people who are real friends. They never think of themselves as separate from each other. That is a state of real love. No emotionality or sentimentality about it, but a simple fact. These two are friends, in the grand sense, the true sense. And if you look deeply into it, what will you find with regard to the way their consciousness functions? They haven't got a sense of, I am Bill, and the other fellow says, I am George. They have a consciousness of us, not of him and me, of us. If this sense of us really grows to its fullness, comes to its true fruition, the sense of unity will pervade us, permeate our being all the time, and our actions, therefore, our thoughts and feelings, as we call them, will be different accordingly. There will be thoughts and feelings and actions which express first and foremost good sense, wisdom, purity, goodness, love, and beauty. Because wheresoever there is harmony, there is beauty. There will be no false comparisons and so forth. If you are a real parent, you don't love this child of yours more or less than that child. You don't love any of your children for any special reasons. You just love totally and completely. This is the fact, is it not? It is where our parenthood has not come to its true maturity, that we say, oh, but my favorite child is so and so. I have caused division by the word my favorite child. All the other children know that, oh, this one's dad's favorite child. And look at the jealousy, the disharmony which is produced thereby. Love is love, total and absolute, immeasurable, like energy, like space. And if that consciousness is within us, then the isolative part of our self-consciousness, the root of sorrow and ill and misery, is out. So then, when we say myself, although in physical fact, it is obvious that there is a person who is so and so, there is another person who is so and so, here am I who am so and so, you see. Whereas that physical fact is there, in mind and consciousness, we are a single mind and a single consciousness. And surely that alone can be the real meaning of the word self. There is only one self. But we have become divisive. Now, if you look at it that way and understand the self, its wholeness, you will be able to resolve certain basic disharmonies. We all know this phrase, the marriage made in heaven. Now, because we think of the self as a separate entity, immortal, some mysterious, immaterial, magical bit which goes on forever and ever, as John Smith, you see. Because of that, we think of heaven as the place there, after death. And so we make all kinds of foolish imaginary pictures in our mind. And we spin out intellectual cobwebs of the most childish, naive, absurd type in relation to it all. As if there were a decree from heaven by individual spirits or whatever they are with respect to marriage. And by marriage we simply mean marriage in the ordinary sense that the world knows. A man marries a woman and she becomes Mrs. So-and-so, and that's that. Now, we know for a fact that the entire universal process is an interplay of positive and negative energies, positive and negative electricity, male and female, yin and yang, and so forth. There is the interplay of these two types. Two fundamental types of energy. Because there is the interplay of these two fundamental types of energy, there is manifestation, a becoming process. When that interplay takes place harmoniously, the one is a proper counterpoint with the other, then we have cosmos, order, beauty,
health, wholeness, happiness, fulfillment, and all these things. When it doesn't take place harmoniously, then we have disorder, misery, destruction, and all the rest of it. Now, supposing we confine our considerations for a moment just to ourselves, as we say, in the ordinary way. We know in modern terminology, and this has been known through the ages, a male body has an anima, a female anima, and a female body has a male animus. We are all masculine and feminine together, with either the masculine or the feminine part preponderating to a certain extent. Very rarely you get a person who, as a psychophysical being, is a perfect harmony of the male and female. That's almost impossible. There is always just a slight imbalance in one direction or other. This is how it actually is. Now, perhaps the first meaning of the marriage made in heaven is so to understand ourselves that we can clearly see the feminine aspect of our psyche, of our minds, if you like, and the masculine aspect of our minds, and bring about their harmonious working together. Not let the one run away with the other. When that harmony is realized, then we have laid the foundation for what we call our own minds to become truly healthy and to reach maturity. All the world, through the ages, realizes physical maturity. Nature does that for us. By the time we have passed puberty and we have grown physically to our full stature and strength, and everything is functioning normally, so to say, assuming that there isn't a congenital disorder or disease, something incurable, but assuming that, the nature brings the body to maturity. Nature does not bring the mind to maturity. That is our personal responsibility. The bringing of the mind to maturity. Now you see, we of all creatures in the world have the capacity to look into ourselves and be able to understand, to observe and to understand, well, first observe, then comprehend, and then perhaps finally understand all our own psychological processes. It is possible for us alone to do that. Your dog can't do it, even your clever dolphin, clever as he is, even he can't do it. And certainly Tarzan's chimpanzee, who talks with Tarzan so efficiently, can't do it, and so forth. But you and I can do it. We can observe, we can comprehend, and we can grow to full understanding of our own inner processes. So now, the bringing of the mind to fulfillment, to fruition, and to maturity is our personal responsibility. And in the bringing of the mind to maturity, we must remember very carefully that we cannot predetermine, we cannot direct how the mind shall move and work in order to become mature. Here now our task is like that of a gardener. What does a gardener do? A good gardener. He is able to distinguish this is good seed, this is not such good seed. All right, he takes good seed and he knows the right soil, what soil should be. He puts the seed in the soil and he does all the necessary things with water and compost heaps and whatnot. And this is the most important thing, lets it grow. Now, this is what hardly anybody in the world can do. We are so unwise that we try to control the processes of life. Life is infinitely more wise than any one of us. We have to let life function through us. This is where we have to be awake, aware, conscious. Letting life function through us and not imposing our desire and all our petty little intellectual preconceptions upon life. So, if the mind is quiet and observant and free of preconceptions, assumptions, prejudices, biases, and all the rest of it, then we can let life work. And it's a wonderful process to watch. The mind grows with the body and comes to maturity. And usually, it takes at least a dozen or a score of years longer than the body. You may ask me, how do I put a measure upon it? Only this way. That in the world's history, the great teachers like Jesus, the Buddha, Zarathustra, any one of them whom you'd like to mention, usually mature round about 30 to 35. Their minds are completely purified, become free of illusions, and have become so pure and so open that they are in touch, in constant living touch with transcendence itself. They are at home with the transcendent just as much as they are home inside a house built of bricks. See? So the mind takes a long time, rather longer than the body. The body comes to maturity, say, from about 16 years onwards. Between 16 and 20 or 22, the body matures. But the mind needs a little longer. If we have been fortunate enough to let the mind come to maturity. So this is the first meaning of the marriage made in heaven. The positive and the negative aspects of the psyche, the male and the female parts of the psyche, are brought into a state of harmony. But is that the end? We say that we are psychophysical organisms. Yes, that is as far as we can positively state. That statement is something which lies well within our knowledge and our experience, psychophysicality, or body-mind unity, yes. But is that a lot? I should never dare to say that. Who knows what other marvelous energies, forms of energy, are here dormant within ourselves, which are waiting to flower out. They will probably take hundreds of thousands, perhaps millions of years to flower out in the human race. But surely, they are bound to flower out. Now, again, the great teachers. As a result of their teachings, as a result of the actual realization by individuals who have gone well beyond what oneself as an ordinary mortal has arrived at, we know that there are what we call archetypal energies, which we have expressed in all sorts of ways. Some have called them archangels and angels and so forth. Not that there are charming creatures in
you know, immaterial creatures, beautiful, with beautiful colors and flashing lights flying through the air. That's all man's imagination and nothing else. The fact is that if you yourself, with the mind purified, in the deep states of consciousness, in quiet, in tune with the universe, you yourself become aware of these transcendent energies. You become aware non-descriptively. This is most important, because description limits it has to limit, otherwise there's no description. Non-descriptively you become aware of these energies. And all that can come within the field of speech and thought is something of the nature of the functioning of these energies. And since our vocabularies, after all, are so limited as they are, we can only use the words that we already have on the side of what we call the good, the true, the beautiful. Now, all the pantheons of the world, as we call them, the gods and goddesses and so forth, they are all ways of talking about ourselves, about our own psychological processes, the emergence of our own awareness into a transcendental state of being and consciousness. It all happens in the mind. This is not to suggest for a single moment that this is all airy-fairy, imaginative moonshine. It isn't. Far from it. Because when it does happen rightly, you are so transformed that your effect upon the world around you is utterly different from the horrible, terrible effects that the ordinary man of the world inflicts upon the world. You consider the world state today, so full of violence and fear and inhumanity everywhere. Everywhere it is that. But as one emerges into this, and becomes aware that there are these transcendent realities hidden, dormant within us. But if one awakes to them, then they begin to function through you. And you never can see, you never should try to see or know the precise forms in which they function. Because that means that a separative I wants to see the results of my work. No. Mine to do the to do my duty, and transcendence reaps the fruit. If that doesn't absolutely fill oneself, then one is selfish and common like anybody else. This is something which lies at the heart of religious living. So, we come then to this transcendent aspect of the male-female energies at work. And those old people who did realize these deep states of vision and understanding used terms which clearly indicate their knowledge of the two factors present, the male-female factors. You take the word Jehovah, Yahweh. Yod He is the masculine part, Vav He is the feminine part. The very word, the very name signifies the union of a masculine and feminine. Take the other name in the Bible, Elohim. Elohim is made up of L-A, L-A, which means the object, the eternal object, and me, M-I. L-A and me, the eternal subject. You see, the eternal object, the eternal what, and the eternal subject, the eternal who. See? Elohim. And these are the words which are translated in the Bible as God. And when Yahweh and Elohim are compounded together, they are translated as Lord God. Now Yahweh represents this immanence within ourselves, these energies, these transcendent energies which bide their time. Transcendence never compels. Eternity is not cursed with the limitations of time. So, the Lord never compels. Transcendence never, therefore, punishes nor rewards. Punishment and reward take place in the process here now in terms of our consciousness of them. Because our consciousness is limited, we see things that way. All right. Take other, for instance, China spoke in terms of yin and yang. India has spoken of the male, female constantly, all the way through. The Trinity itself, the Hindu Trinity, Brahma, Vishnu, Shiva, each one of those male aspects has his feminine counterpart. And the feminine counterpart is always what we call the Shakti, the power, the strength, which produces activity and manifestation. The male is of less consequence and importance where doing things is concerned. We are like the grand seigneurs, you know, who just sit at home and do nothing to earn our living. Then the lady comes along and takes us a step down, and we lose our dignity as grand seigneurs and we become ordinary seigneurs, you see, which means that we do a little work in order to make our living. That's the difference between the grand seigneur and the seigneur. So now, the feminine counterpart is presented. You find the same in Mahayana Buddhism. All the great Dhyani Buddhas, as they are called. You see? Not that they are particular individuals, not at all. This is the way the thing has been talked of in order to tell us what happens inside our own selves. Religion teaches you a psychology which is transcendental psychology. It's an unerring psychology because it knows that, because these people who taught it knew the mind in its totality, in its perfection, because their own minds were purified. The Dhyani Buddhas, they have their own feminine counterparts, the Shakti, the power. And they are always in active interplay. What I have called in my new book the state of timeless conjugation. See? So now, the self. What are you, the self? What am I, a self? To start with, the real meaning is that the self is the totality, the one and only self. But if you were to tell this to a very fundamentalist, orthodox theologian, you'll say, oh, this is dangerous pantheism, this is horrible, this is awful. Well, tell the theologian to examine the matter if he is capable of such examination. Mustn't be assumed that because a person has a degree or something, therefore he has real capacity. Not necessary. People imagine that just because they have been through a university training, therefore, they say, oh, let me examine this and see for myself. There is the conceited assumption that I have the real capacity to examine this. Have we? You see how easy it is to fall into traps like that. So now, the marriage made in heaven means that this self, which is the total self, is, I come back to my old phrase, a congeries of energies in interplay. What one may call action in eternity. The mystery of the creative pulse no man may know. That is quite beyond all human knowing. But one can be in tune with that creative pulse because one has become utterly purified and utterly awakened to reality. And in that state, you can make certain statements, just a few statements, which are not intended to convey precise factual realities, because that belongs to a material realm more than any other, but to give the stimulus, the impetus for the listener who cares to listen, who cares to understand, and cares to explore for himself to realize the fulfillment of his own true human nature.